Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us. Today, the latest on health and healing, we're going to talk about chamomile as a natural cancer fighter, how DDT increases the risk of Alzheimer's. We're going to explore an ingredient in grapefruit that reduces cervical and breast cancer tumors by up to 75%. And also, we'll be dispelling the myth that your memory is accurate. Your memory is no video camera. It edits the past with present experiences, making it very unreliable. Also, more information on why sugar is bad from Harvard School of Public Health, as published in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Internal Medicine, increases your risk of dying of a heart attack. Compelling evidence. We'll also be talking about lingonberries. Have you heard of them? Have you ever eaten them? They're good, and they can block the effects of a fat diet. So, a lot more on health and nutrition. My guest in the second part of our program will be a newsmaker guest, a short piece on the California water crisis. Many of the people listening right now live in California. Formerly, they had listened to me for 31 years until just about 6 months ago on KPFK. I chose to leave KPFK because of all this politics, and I did not like what I saw there. But they've continued listening, and I get all these pieces of information where people ask, what lies ahead for us if we're staying? I've invited Matthew Herberger, who is the research associate with the Pacific Institute for Water Program in Oakland, California. He is an expert in biological engineering from Cornell and Tufts University, and he's going to tell us the California water crisis, what lies ahead. Then from our environmental segment today, Monsanto CEO admits they need more propaganda to defeat GMO activists. Also, how Monsanto's Food Act destroys small farms. Then we're going to look at five facts about farm-raised fish that many people are eating that maybe they wouldn't if they know this information. Then continuing with my commentaries, I'll be talking about what's the real underlying motive behind so many bad choices in Washington. Also, fast-tracking misery, Nation of Change, Ron Carver on Trans-Pacific Partnership, and if time permits, Marjorie Cohen, Beyond Orwell's Worst Nightmare. Also, I do not have the full time to play it on this program, but I will certainly play about 10 minutes or so of Edward Snowden's interview with a major German magazine. It is extraordinarily revealing. Now, we've had a heck of a time trying to keep this up on the web, because everywhere you look, it's being cleaned off the web. So you'll have a chance to hear it, and then you'll have a chance to download it. Let's begin. I can remember when the only tea out there that was popular in the 1970s in the health food stores was chamomile. And people used it because there was a lot of reports that it calmed people. And especially in the evening, if you were having a trouble getting to sleep, you had a cup of chamomile tea. Well, now there are thousands of studies about chamomile. This comes from the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. And here's what it says. Chamomile is a natural cancer fighter and a sleep promoter. So it is true that chamomile is great at promoting relaxation and deep sleep. But it also fights anxiety, depression, and especially cancer. Now, research shows that chamomile is able to trigger cancer cell death, a phenomena that is unique where the cancer cell actually dies. Its active component is called apigenin. Now, apigenin can shorten the lifespan and the proliferation of breast cancer cells. As Ohio State University reports, apigenin can actually help, quote, fix flaws in molecules carrying generic information. And such flaws are responsible for many cancers. So researchers at Ohio State University found that apigenin was able to join forces with 160 proteins in the body, whereas conventional cancer treatments only work with a molecule-by-molecule basis, and they surmise that cancer-affected proteins are lured into the apigenin where it can work to eliminate the disease. So that's really good news. So if you know anyone who is having problems, especially with breast cancer, get them taking chamomile. If you have bloating, insomnia, PMS, cramps, migraines, rashes, mouth sores, and gum disease, chamomile can help all of them. I can also recall when Rachel Carson was the person most responsible for our current environmental movement. She didn't have a lot of help. I remember when we were trying to educate the public about DDT, there might be five or six of us show up to demonstrate against DDT. People weren't into the environment. They didn't understand it. They didn't understand that a chemical that was so widely used for such a long period of time could be so destructive. Because to have accepted our argument would have been to have accepted that the authority figures, in effect, the father figures in every institution would have betrayed them. And so they simply walked on by. Frequently wouldn't even take the handouts we were giving. But in time, due to a national effort, we were able to get DDT banned. But it's persistent. It can stay in the environment for a long period of time, and worse still, it can be used on crops outside the United States, brought back into the United States, and then you eat it. It happens all the time. This is the latest from Natural News. DDT increases the risk of Alzheimer's disease. I'll quote this. It says, Alzheimer's disease is a neurodegenerative condition that adversely affects cognitive function, with about 44 million people worldwide who have dementia diseases. By the way, I know many of those people myself. And it's terrible because you go from dementia into this deteriorating state where you lose almost all short-term memory. Now, the causes of Alzheimer's are many, but principally it's due to inflammatory conditions that adversely affect the genes. And environmental aspects are right at the top of the list. Pesticides, herbicides, heavy metals, solvents, all have been shown to have a detrimental effect on people. Now it's been shown that exposure to DDT also is a part of this. So you're going to say, but it's been banned. It's a long way since we banned it in 1972. That's correct. And it can stay 50 years in the environment. So even though DDT was deemed to be very effective as a pesticide, eventually it became evident that its effects on the environment and humans and wildlife were devastating. It has long been known that the chemical causes reproductive problems in people, and it causes cancers, and now we can show that it can adversely affect the brain. Researchers at Rutgers University and Emory University compared the blood of 86 people diagnosed with Alzheimer's with 79 healthy people same age. Both groups had the same background, same age. The results show that the levels of the DDT of the Alzheimer's patients was about 380% higher than the healthy group. So that is the bad news. Now, what could be the positive to this? I have seen with my own experience helping a lot of people, including in a clinical study, that if you get off all pro-inflammatory agents, if you radically change your diet to a healthy, clean food, living food diet, and lots of juices. We're talking about upwards of 10 to 12 juices a day, organic materials, that you can chelate out and substantially halt the progression of Alzheimer's and dementia and make improvements. It was 5 years ago that I noticed in a friend of mine short-term memory loss. It happened when we were having dinner. And normally we have dinner about once a week. And I've known this man almost since I've been in New York. And he's very famous. He's a world-renowned person. Very kind, very gentle, very, very creative. And at this particular dinner, he would look at the menu, and then we would chat, and then I'd say, what are you going to order? And he'd say, well, let me look at the menu. He'd look at the menu again. This happened 5 times. So I said, how many times have you looked at the menu? And he said, I'm looking at it now. How many? One. No, 5 times. During the conversation, he could recall with clarity things that happened 10 years ago, 30 years ago. He could not recall things that day. And I said, you need to see a holistic neurologist. Here's a number of a friend of mine. You need to have some tests done. I'm concerned you may be suffering from dementia. Oh, no, no, no. You know, how could that be? I'm a vegetarian. I said, because of all the chemicals in your work, and because of your stress, and because of the environment you live in, all of that contributes to this. And it's cumulative. Well, he did. And to his credit, he found out that he was having some problems, and I put him on a protocol. He began to improve. Then he went on an extensive trip, went off the protocol, and went right back to where he began. Because once you start, so everyone understands, you can stop protocols, you revert right back to where you were. So it's not like you do something good for a week or a month and then, hey, that's good. See, we've improved. Now I don't have to do it anymore. Wrong. You must do that every day. And now this person is really gone. And I've seen personally up close with many friends the effects of dementia. Now, if this person got into a formal environment where every day everything was done for him as far as this juice is, because he can't do it himself now, he will forget. And the people around him, quite frankly, they don't care. And that's the sad part of many of these things, when the family doesn't believe in any of this, or they're not going to inconvenience themselves to do it. So I'm just thinking, you know, there'll be a time in the near future where to sit down and have a conversation. It's highly unlike this person will remember even who I am or our friendship. That's how that goes. Now imagine that you walk into a room and your mom doesn't recognize you. Who are you? I'm your son. I'm your daughter. No, you're not. This happens. And that's the tragic part, because physically they may look all right. Their brain's gone. So when you start to chelate, you can have remarkable benefits. You can actually reverse the amyloid plaque. Then with the nutrients that the brain requires for rebuilding, glycerophosphorylcholine, phosphatidylserine, phosphatidylcholine, acetyl-L-carnitine, carnosine, benfenamine, the B-complex, methylated folic acid, methylated B12, high levels of certain herbs like ginseng and Dong Quai, you can make an enormous difference. By the way, I was just getting ready for a big interview. We have a 16-hour filming tomorrow in Berkeley. 16 hours, and every second is filled. Half-hour interviews, lots of people to finish this particular part of the film. We got 9 more cities to go to in the next 20 days. In any case, and some of these are really dynamite documentaries. And we're trying to get them all ready to present this summer with one huge one, Poverty Inc. In any case, I was looking for some information on one of the people that were filming. And I was just on this one website and I saw that The Joy of Juicing, the documentary that I did, had 147,000 downloads. So people are looking to detoxify. People are looking to rebuild. And juicing is simply an inexpensive, natural, safe way of doing it. So anyone you know over the age of 40 should be juicing at least 4 fresh organic glasses of juice a day. We all want to help reduce and prevent the mortality and incidence of breast and cervical cancers. Some really exciting news shows how one single nutrient called NAR, N-A-R, NARINGIN, is from grapefruits, and it reduces cervical and breast cancer tumors by up to 75%. Now, studies show that people suffering from cancer tumors due to malnutrition and cachexia, which is very high levels of inflammatory cytokines in their cells, which causes weakening or severe illness, respond exceptionally well to treatment with NARINGIN. And when laboratory animals have been tested most prominently for their response to this NARINGIN, there are hundreds of these studies carried out on people as well. They've had complete tumor regression. In one instance, women suffering from cervical cancer who use NARINGIN experience a, quote, marked ability to inhibit preclinical models of epithelial cancer cell growth and tumor formation, end quote. Other studies, it was the what was called apoptosis, APO, ptosis, PTOSIS, means suicide of cancer cells. And NARINGIN is both chemopreventative and anti-carcinogenic. So, very important. Quote, NARINGIN showed a 50% inhibition of SIHA human cervical cancer cells at a concentration of 750 UM. The cancer cells exhibited cell death and DNA fragmentation, morphological changes, and decline in the mitochondrial transmembrane potential, end quote. Means when they took the NARINGIN, the cancer cells died. And it's natural. So let's make sure that the women in our lives or friends know this very important information. I find all the time in my counseling and lectures and support groups and the research for the major new book I have coming up for young people between the ages of 18 and 35, that memory is almost never accurate. And I find that people make old events that were positive, negative, negative events, positive, change events around, change the context, change the emotional expression. And you think, well, I thought once something was in your memory, it's there forever. It's not true. Here's the latest research on this that support this. This is from Northwestern Medicine, published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Neuroscience. This was also done at the Feinberg School of Medicine. Quote, your memory, this is from Northwestern University, your memory is a wily time traveler, plucking fragments of the present and inserting them into the past. In terms of accuracy, it's no video camera. Rather, the memory rewrites the past with current information, updating your recollections with new experiences. Love at first sight, for example, is more likely a trick of your memory than a Hollywood-worth moment. Quote, when you think back to when you met your current partner, you may recall this feeling of love and euphoria, writes Professor Donna Jo Bridge, the fellow in medical social sciences at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine. Quote, but you may be projecting your current feelings back to the original encounter with that person. So it didn't happen that way, but you needed it today to have happened that way. Now, this is the first study to show specifically how memory is faulty and how it can insert things from the present into memories of the past when those memories are retrieved. And the study shows the exact point in time when that incorrectly recalled information gets implanted into the existing memory. Quote, our memory is not a video camera. Your memory reframes and edits events to create a story to fit your current world. It's built to be current. And then it goes into the the hippocampus, the brain, and where memory is factored. Now, what does this mean? Well, for me, it means this. How often do we try to make sense of the past, but if today our life is not going the way we want, if we don't have control of the circumstances that we once had, and hence we're feeling distressed, maybe our job is insecure, or we're not in a partnership, whatever it may be, we're feeling lonely, feeling old, feeling unappreciated, feeling unwanted. These are common thoughts. Our memory will take us back to a time when we believe that things were better, and then we live in our memory. Or our brain can take us back to where we believe we were victimized that justifies what's happened to us today, neither of which can be true. Well, let me give you the most clear-cut example of this. I remember when the McMartin family, first it was Bucky McMartin, but then the entire McMartin family was indicted, arrested. He was kept in confinement in what became the longest trial and the most expensive trial in California history to that time for sexual abuse. It started with one little girl, but by the end there were dozens who had claimed that they had been sexually abused. Mind you, this is a school that had all glass walls, so you could see in every room. And the statements of the children as the trial went on became more and more extreme. What was important to my perspective was they had not yet been found guilty by a jury of their peers. So therefore, even if the allegations were horrific, we should stay neutral until we see all the evidence and until it's adjudicated. But immediately, all the press immediately attacked them, especially this one woman who writes for the Daily News. I don't think this woman's ever had a happy day in her life. She needs some serious psychological counseling. She hates everyone and everything. I mean, it's just like she wakes up each day, and as she opens her mouth, she doesn't have bad breath. She has flames flowing. And she led the charge, but everybody condemned these people. I didn't find one single person in the media that was at least waiting for the evidence. And so I clipped all these services, and I wanted to see would there be a single person in the American media that would wait till the trial was over. Not one. They were all on it. And then they were all found innocent, not guilty of all charges. And then it came out, the video of the school teacher coaching one little girl who said nothing had happened, nothing had happened, nothing had happened, repeatedly nothing had happened. And then the psychologist or the sociologist held up a little doll. Well, you see, Billy and Jane and Bobby and all your friends, they all said that this happened. And then the girl says, okay, that happened. She was coached. She wanted to be with the other kids. She didn't want to stand out. And so she agreed. It was only when the videos were shown of a little girl who had nothing wrong with her, no medical examination showed any molestation to anyone, only the power of coaching. And at that time, America went through an epidemic of false sexual accusations. Someone I personally know was accusing their own father of sexually abusing them when they were 3 years old. And I said, how do you know? Well, I just know. My psychologist told me that that's why I'm having problems in my relationships, because I had been sexually abused. I said, you're allowing a psychologist to implant in your mind something? Your father's a loving father. You've only had wonderful things to say about your father. Your father's a person of integrity. Well, that's what I thought, but now I know the truth. No, you don't know the truth. This woman went on a rip to destroy her father. Her father ended up dying of a stroke, only later to find out that, you know, no, she had a false memory. Kind of hard to bring your dad back when you've caused his death. So the next time someone gets accused of something, just remember, our brains are fully capable of creating, distorting, altering, editing, fabricating anything we want, or things that we're not even sure of or aware of. That's how pliable our consciousness is, and the science is now there to verify it. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment, and when we come back, I'm going to give you some environmental information, then we're going to go directly to a 10-minute clip from Edward Snowden. We're going to have a newsmaker about what's going on in California. I'm going to also share one last study, by the way, because it's very important to us. Really stop the sugar. It's in your best interest. Harvard School of Public Health, quote, new research recently published in the Journal of the American Medical Association's publication Internal Medicine suggests that individuals who consume high amounts of added sugar in their diet may be at increased risk of death from cardiovascular disease. According to Harvard School of Public Health, the average American consumes 22 teaspoons of added sugar a day. That's an extra 350 calories a day. That's mainly from sweets, cakes, biscuits, chocolate, and soft drinks. The team headed by Professor Yang, Division of Heart Disease and Stroke Prevention at the Center for Disease Control, notes a regular can of soda contains 35 grams of sugar. That's 140 calories. And previous research associated a high added sugar intake with increased risk of cardiovascular disease. But the investigators say that a few studies have looked at the link between added sugar intake and cardiovascular disease death. And then they went ahead and found that there was an enormous increase in death from sugar. In fact, this is what's important. Quote, those who consume more than 21% of their daily calories from added sugar had double the risk of death from heart attacks and strokes. Now, there's two types of sugar. There's processed sugars and there's natural sugars. This has nothing in the world to do with natural sugars. Natural sugars, if you eat an apple or pear or plum or cherries or pineapples, that's not going to cause you to get a heart attack. That's actually good for you. We're talking about processed sugars, and that's what you want to stay away from. And by the way, from Lund University in Sweden, quote, up to 20% of the research project show that the use of lingonberries, can block the effects of a high-fat diet. You're not going to be able to find lingonberries in most of your markets. You can certainly find it in health food stores. So if you tend to be overweight or diabetic, if you're going through menopause and not able to keep your weight down, not because you're overeating, but because your hormones have changed, then simply take some of these. You can get them in dried form, and they're fine, they're tasty, they're like a mulberry. And this was published in the Journal of Nutrition and Metabolism. Please stay with us. Back in a moment. Have you with us? Hope that you look at the articles that we post or write. The latest article, the original in-depth investigative reporting article, Fluoride Killing Us Softly, has been featured throughout the web on 50,000 social shares and 100,000 headline impressions, so, and over a million reads. it means that a lot of people are being educated on a public health issue that is important. The dangers of something that's put into our water that we don't need doesn't help us and hurts us. It's fully scientifically vetted, and the scholarship in it is good enough that you could take it into a court of law and certainly bring it up as a legitimate scientific challenge if you have fluoridated water and you believe that it's dangerous and you want to get it out, but you don't know what to say. Everything you need to defluoridate your local water supply, I have supplied in this article. Every single statement is backed up by peer-reviewed independent scientific journals. So you have the science, you have the experts, you have the facts, and all over the world, people are using this information to challenge fluoridation in their water supply. And by the way, anyone who is doing it, who has succeeded, please let us know. Just go to GaryNall.com and share that information. But it's up on ProgressiveRadarNetwork.com, and you can read that article. From our environmental segment today, Monsanto CEO admits they need more propaganda to defeat GMO activists. This is from Christina Sarich from Natural News. Quote, in Nazi Germany, the use of propaganda was taken to newer and more perverse levels than the world had ever seen. But 2014 just might have a spin machine that can trump it. Welcome to the Monsanto GMO lie apparatus. It works well when it feeds millions and appoints imbeciles to public office and breaks down with the activism of countless citizens. Recently, Monsanto's CEO admitted that the industry needs to do more to sway the public and convince everyone that GMOs, genetically modified organisms, are the one and only answer. Proposals to have GMO foods labeled are gaining traction in many states. And while labeling bill in St. Louis was recently discussed at Monsanto's annual shareholder meeting, it was openly admitted that more propaganda was needed to defeat the growing surge of pro-GMO legislation. GMO, or Monsanto, wants you to know just how good their poison crops are for you. And you really don't need to know what's in your food, do you? Just shut up and eat it already. Of course, investors in Monsanto stock certainly don't want labeling either. That means their ill-gotten millions would dwindle to the value of genetically modified corn stalks. They made it abundantly clear at the meeting. Only individuals representing about 4% of shares were in favor of GMO labeling. Monsanto's chief executive, Hugh Grant, did show up at the meeting and added to his own admission that the company had some fierce critics. Quote, we simply haven't engaged enough at the level we should have with all of our audiences, and for that we apologize. There's a recognition we need to do more. End quote. Yeah. Well, you've controlled it all. You control the White House. You controlled all the presidents on this issue. You have Tom Vilsack, the most pro-GMO governor in American history, as Secretary of Agriculture. You have the top Monsanto, your former lawyer, running the Food and Drug Administration safety policy in Washington. But you had a few people stand up and question, why are these rats getting cancer? Why are none of your studies more than 30 days? Why, when Dr. Saralini and a group of scientists ran the study for the full length of the life of the rat, they develop all these cancers and all these other diseases? Why is it there's no safety study ever done on GMOs? And then public began to listen. So, yeah, you had someone actually fight back. So you're going to have to spend a lot more money and do a lot more because the public is becoming aware. This is from Natural Blaze, Randy Ananda. Quote, on par with Stalin's farm collectivism program of the 1930s, Monsanto's push to the tune of $8.8 million in lobbying bribes alone for the Food Safety Modernization Act is already achieving the nightmares of its worst critics. Introduced in 2008 by Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, Democrat from Connecticut, H.R. 875, the reworked FSMA, was signed into law in January 2011 by President Obama. DeLauro's husband, Stanley Greenberg, served as a consultant to Monsanto through his strategic political consulting firm Greenberg Quinlan Rosner Research. They also advised Bill Clinton in their campaigns and Tony Blair as well. Nothing in the FSMA addresses the food safety issue of pesticide residue, genetically modified crops, or food miles, which increase the chance of spoilage. But the SMFMA requires all commercial farms to test the streams used to irrigate the crops. Quote, the 1,200-page act was designed to put small farm family farms out of business, explains Michael Tabor in a recent farm-to-consumer interview. Quote, most farmers irrigate their fields from nearby streams. Now, those streams have to be tested on a weekly basis. At $87.50 per testing, this increases the cost of doing business by $5,000 a year. Biotech crops and chemical farms get a free pass for polluting our land, our air, and our water, while downstreamers all are required to prove their streams aren't contaminated. How's that for a catch-22? Extra paperwork and unannounced on-farm inspections by federal regulators backed by armed personnel interrupts the workflow and harasses the small family farms. Yet the minute additional paperwork involved in labeling GMO food is said to be too expensive for the biotech industry, so we're told. Quote, totalitarian dictatorships work to achieve absolute obedience and control, instructs one college textbook. Quote, employing various forms of coercion and terror, the regime suppresses independent thought and controls every aspect of daily life. What a terrifying experience it must be for a farmstead to be raided while armed agents hold you and your children hostage as they destroy your product, which has sickened no one. But that's exactly what is happening to the natural food industry. And it's not an occasional event. They're treating produce as a high-risk food. Are they out of their minds? No, they're not. They're systematically criminalizing organic farms and gardens through the use of bureaucratic rules. Falling in lockstep with the feds, cities across the nation are banning residential gardens and criminalizing charity. Feeding the homeless is considered a nuisance, while church bake sales and community picnics are also being criminalized across this once free nation. Criminalizing the people who want to feed themselves is a surefire way to achieve globalist aims for reducing human issues. And then it goes on to talk about some farms they raided. That is what's going on behind the scenes. Finally, five facts about farm-raised fish you should know. Because a lot of people, when they go in the store, they just want the fish they see. And if it's salmon or tilapia or catfish, think of this. Farm-raised fish can be filled with disease. And that's because they're so crowded and compact. And disease is rampant. In fact, as Mind Body Green reports, sea lice has destroyed 80% of pink salmon in some populations. Farm fish can decimate the prey fish populations, though some fish are fed corn and soy, and others are fed smaller prey fish. As a result, these fish are being consumed to the point of extinction. Farm fish simply aren't good for you, because farm fish are not eating their natural diet of seaweed. In most circumstances, they're not in good health. This means their omega-3 concentrations are not the same as the wild counterparts. Plus, they're given antibiotics, and those come into your body. And fish farms cause serious environmental damage. They can cause a lot of pollution to natural waterways. And also, their mislabeled fish can mean getting farm varieties without knowing it. One study found 25 to 70% of seafood was mislabeled, labeled as different fish or as coming from different sources. Salmon was labeled as being wild-caught, was in fact 56% of it was farm-raised. I'm Gary Knoll. Let's now hear a part of an interview with Snowden, and then you can go to the website and download the entire interview. It is extremely disturbing. Here it is.
Mr. Snowden, did you sleep well the last couple of nights? Because I was reading that you asked for a kind of police protection. Are there any threats?
There are significant threats, but I sleep very well. There was an article that came out in an online outlet called BuzzFeed, where they interviewed officials from the Pentagon, from the National Security Agency, and they gave them anonymity to be able to say what they wanted. And what they told the reporter was that they wanted to murder me. These individuals, and these are acting government officials, they said they would be happy, they would love to put a bullet in my head, to poison me as I was returning from the grocery store, and have me die in the shower.
But fortunately, you're still alive with us.
Right, but I'm still alive, and I don't lose sleep, because I've done what I feel I needed to do. It was the right thing to do, and I'm not going to be afraid.
The greatest fear I have, and I quote you, regarding these disclosures, is nothing will change. That was one of your greatest concerns at the time. But in the meantime, there is a vivid discussion about the situation with the NSA, not only in America, but also in Germany and in Brazil. And President Obama was forced to go public and to justify what the NSA was doing on legal grounds.
What we saw initially in response to the revelations was sort of a circling of the wagons of government around the National Security Agency. Instead of circling around the public and protecting their rights, the political class circled around the security state and protected their rights. What's interesting is, though that was the initial response, since then we've seen a softening. We've seen the president acknowledge that when he first said, we've drawn the right balance, there are no abuses, we've seen him and his officials admit that there have been abuses. There have been thousands of violations of the National Security Agency and other agencies' authorities every single year.
Is the speech of Obama recently the beginning of a serious regulation?
It was clear from the president's speech that he wanted to make minor changes to preserve authorities that we don't need. The president created a review board from officials that were personal friends, from national security insiders, former deputy of the CIA, people who had every incentive to be soft on these programs and to see them in the best possible light. But what they found was that these programs have no value. They've never stopped a terrorist attack in the United States, and they have marginal utility at best for other things. The only thing that the Section 215 phone metadata program, actually it's a broader metadata program, a bulk collection means mass surveillance program, was in stopping or detecting an $8,500 wire transfer from a cab driver in California. And it's this kind of review where insiders go, we don't need these programs. These programs don't make us safe. They take a tremendous amount of resources to run, and they offer us no value. They go, we can modify these. The National Security Agency operates under the president's executive authority alone. He can end or modify or direct a change in their policies at any time.
For the first time, President Obama did concede that the NSA collects and stores trillions of data.
Every time you pick up the phone, dial a number, write an email, make a purchase, travel on the bus carrying a cell phone, swipe a card somewhere, you leave a trace. And the government has decided that it's a good idea to collect it all. Everything, even if you've never been suspected of any crime. Traditionally, the government would identify a suspect, they would go to a judge, they would say, we suspect he's committed this crime, they would get a warrant, and then they would be able to use the totality of their powers in pursuit of the investigation. Nowadays, what we see is they want to apply the totality of their powers in advance, prior to an investigation.
You started this debate. Edward Snowden is, in the meantime, a household name for the whistleblower in the age of the Internet. You were working till last summer for the NSA, and during this time you collected secretly thousands of confidential documents. What was the decisive moment, or was there a long period of time or something happening? Why did you do this?
I would say sort of the breaking point is seeing the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, directly lie under oath to Congress. There's no saving an intelligence community that believes it can lie to the public and the legislators who need to be able to trust it and regulate its actions. Seeing that really meant for me there was no going back. Beyond that, It was the creeping realization that no one else was going to do this. The public had a right to know about these programs. The public had a right to know that which the government is doing in its name and that which the government is doing against the public. But neither of these things we were allowed to discuss, we were allowed to know. Even the wider body of our elected representatives were prohibited from knowing or discussing these programs, and that's a dangerous thing. The only review we had was from a secret court, the FISA court, which is a sort of rubber stamp authority. When you are on the inside, when you go into work every day, when you sit down at the desk and you realize the power you have, you can wiretap the President of the United States. You can wiretap a federal judge. And if you do it carefully, no one will ever know, because the only way the NSA discovers abuses are from self-reporting.
We are not talking only of the NSA as far as this is concerned. There is a multilateral agreement for cooperation among the services. And this alliance of intelligence operations is known as the Five Eyes. What agencies and countries belong to this alliance, and what is its purpose?
The Five Eyes Alliance is sort of an artifact of the post-World War II era, where the Anglophone countries of the major powers banded together to sort of cooperate and share the costs of intelligence gathering infrastructure. So we have the UK's GCHQ, we have the US NSA, we have Canada's CSEC, we have the Australian Signals Intelligence Directorate, and we have New Zealand's DSD. What the result of this was over decades and decades was sort of a supranational intelligence organization that doesn't answer to the laws of its own countries.
In many countries, as in America too, the agencies like the NSA are not allowed to spy within their own borders on their own people. So the Brits, for example, they can spy on everybody but the Brits. But the NSA can conduct surveillance in England. So at the very end, they could exchange their data and they would be strictly following the law.
If you asked the governments about this directly, they would deny it and point to policy agreements between the members of the Five Eyes, saying that they won't spy on each other's citizens. But there are a couple key points there. One is that the way they define spying is not the collection of data. The GCHQ is collecting an incredible amount of data on British citizens, just as the National Security Agency is gathering an enormous amount of data on U.S. citizens. What they're saying is that they will not then target people within that data. They won't look for UK citizens or British citizens. In addition, the policy agreements between them that say British won't target US citizens, US won't target British citizens, are not legally binding. The actual memorandums of agreement state specifically on that, that they're not intended to put a legal restriction on any government. They're policy agreements that can be deviated from or broken at any time. So if they want to spy on a British citizen, they can spy on a British citizen. And then they can even share that data with the British government that is itself.
That was just a small amount of an interview. The full interview, which is really interesting and even more compelling the further you listen, with Edward Snowden speaking in Russia with a German journalist. You can go to our website and download. It's been virtually wiped clean by the Department of Defense off the websites everywhere. Let us now go to California, Oakland, California, and say hello to Matthew Herberger. Nice to have you with us, Matthew.
Hi, good morning. Good to be with you.
Matthew is a research associate with the Pacific Institute's Water Program in Oakland, a nonprofit research center that assesses how threats to sustainability, especially on water management and human rights, are perceived and solved. He is a licensed professional water engineer with degrees in agriculture and biochemical engineering from Cornell and advanced degrees in water resource engineering from Tufts University. And he has also worked as a water engineer for a consulting firm in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Matthew, let's just take a look for a moment what's happening in California. California Central Valley agriculture earns about $45 billion a year. Half of the U.S. fruit, nuts, and vegetables come from California. Sacramento-San Joaquin watershed is the largest watershed in the valley's agriculture. Now the farmers are being forced to tap into unsustainable water reserves, and since most of the farming in the valley relies upon industrial chemical agricultural methods, water usage is much higher than in the traditional farming methods. Now, James Hansen, back in 1990, made the prediction of California drought and drought throughout the Southwest due to the anthropocentric global warming, but no one in government and state and federal has done much to prepare for this. One climatologist, Kevin Trentberth, seems to capture the problem well. He says, quote, "The extra heat from the increase in the heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere over 6 months is equivalent to running a small microwave oven at full power for about a half an hour over every square foot of the land under the drought. No wonder wildfires have increased," end quote. So here are the issues, if you would, in this Newsmaker segment to bring us up to date on.
Well,
it's
a big topic to chew off. Talking about climate change and California agriculture, these are all really important things for us out here on the West Coast. And I like to say that water is really the delivery mechanism for climate change. It's how most of us are going to feel the impact first in terms of droughts and water shortages. Sure, there's also, we're going to be looking at heat waves and wildfires and all sorts of other things, but even ignoring climate change, drought is a natural and recurring part of the West's climate. If you look back in the records, scientists have done things like look at tree rings and lake sediments, and you see, looking back in the last hundreds or thousands of years, we have droughts that sometimes last 30 to 50 years. And we've done a lot of our water planning in the West in the last century, which we're now learning was above average in terms of the amount of water that we had in our lakes and rivers. And so we are looking at a future where we need to use less and we need to use water more efficiently. And we've begun doing a lot of that throughout the Southwest and in California, but there's a lot more that we need to do going forward.
Okay, a few quick answers, if you would, please.
Mm-hmm.
What is the likely outcome for people living throughout the state, those who are going to be least affected, and those who are definitely going to be severely affected?
Well, it looks like right now everyone's going to feel an impact somewhat. The governor has issued an across-the-board request for everyone to cut their water use by 20%, and so really the onus is on everyone. But like you mentioned in your opening, it's irrigators, it's agriculture that's really feeling the biggest pinch. The way the water systems work in California is that most of the rain and the moisture is in the north part of the state, and some of the most productive agriculture is in the southern part of the Great Central Valley, which is relatively dry, and they rely on water that's stored in dams and then shipped hundreds of miles via canals to these farm fields. And in wet years, they're able to grow a lot of crops, millions of acres of cropland in the state, about 9 million acres of irrigated farmland. But in dry years, there's just not enough water to irrigate all that land. And so a number of irrigation districts have been put on notice by the state authorities, saying they can only expect 5% of their normal water deliveries or in some cases none. Now, that doesn't mean they won't be growing anything. It means a lot of them are going to be turning to groundwater. So they'll be pumping water from wells, which is more expensive. And I've read reports that there's been a spate of new well drilling and deepening of existing wells, which has its own issues of declining aquifer levels, land subsidence, all sorts of negative side effects that go along with that.
What do you see as the, let's say, over the next 5 years, do you see a substantial challenge to the agricultural community? And what about the value of living in a state, as certainly in those areas where you're not going to have reliance upon water on any predictable basis?
Yeah, well, I think that's true. That when you say the average, it doesn't really, our climate is so variable in the West that the average doesn't really tell you what you're going to expect. And I think we need to move to a future where we're more resilient to these droughts. And I think we can learn a lot of lessons from, for instance, Australia, which lived through about 10 years of severe drought. And there were a lot of difficult decisions they had to make in terms of retiring some existing farmland and literally paying farmers to abandon their land because there wasn't enough water to go around. And in cities, their water use is much, much lower than ours. We're looking at averages of 175 or 200 gallons per person per day, whereas in a lot of Australian cities, they've learned to live with 30 or 40 gallons per person. So there's a lot more that we could be doing. Now, in terms of the future, you know, I can't predict what the rain is going to be next week, much less next year. And unfortunately, people do tend to forget about the dry times after it's rained and we've got full reservoirs. Unfortunately, it tends to be business as usual. So in the water policy business, I think it's an important window during these droughts to push through some reforms that can help make us more resilient. And I think what we absolutely must not do is use the drought as an excuse to roll back environmental protections, which have been so hard won. And a lot of your listeners may not know, but California has had more extinctions than any other state, and most of those have been aquatic species, and it was directly a result of drying up rivers and wetlands, and that's the reason we've lost those species. Now, these days, we have the Endangered Species Act, which is a lifeline to protect some of these not only important species, but some of these ecosystems, which we all rely upon. And so we absolutely must not use the drought as an excuse to roll back any of these protections that have been so hard won.
I agree. The most important endangered species is an honest politician in California. I think there are three of them left. Matthew, thank you very much for sharing these insights with us.
Great. You're very welcome.
Matthew Herberger from the research at the Pacific Institute's Water Program in Oakland, California. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all very much for listening, and I look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Now let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann. Oh, she's not there. Let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today, the second of the two-part presentation on health and healthcare disparities in the United States.
All right. What angle will you be talking about today?
The Civil Rights Act of 1964 and ways it can be amended, especially in the use of federal funds to federal agencies in health care.
Do you realize what impact, if we had universal health care and if it would have had it like in a civilized country, what that would have done for the lives of those who are at the lower end of the economic scale in this country?
Well, you know, it is the best solution. It still is the best solution, but the president just seems immune to it. He seems to be more Republican than the Republicans on this question.
Yes, he is. Thank you, Utrice Lead, coming at you right now.